Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi everyone, welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. Now, as you'll know, I am doing History Hit Live on YouTube, on the Timeline channel on YouTube, three times a week during this lockdown, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 4 p.m. UK time, 8 a.m. Pacific and 11 a.m. Eastern time. So head over to Timeline and watch those. We've had Susanna Lipscomb on, we've had Dan Jones, we got Mary Beard coming up. We've got all sorts of wonderful people. And the first one that went out is one that's proved very, very popular. There's people watching it with Professor Mark Bailey. He's a professor at the University of East Anglia, and he is a specialist in, you guessed it, the Black Death. We decided we'd start with the Black Death. It's what people seem to be talking about and making dodgy historical comparisons to, so we thought we'd go straight to the man himself and find out about the scale of the Black Death, which initially swept through Europe from Western Asia in the middle of the 14th century, but also its impact on communities, its aftermath, economic, social, and cultural and political changes that followed in its wake, and try and stimulate some thought about how the current crisis might change the world that we live in. So enjoy this. If you want to watch this one or any of them, they're all available on the Timeline YouTube channel. Go and check them out, as is me talking about my favourite historical movies. That was a Easter Bank Holiday Monday special, so go and check that one out. And disagree with them if you will, like everyone seems to have done. If you want to watch even more historical documentaries, if you want to listen to all these back episodes of the podcast, go to History Hit. It's the new digital history channel. It's like Netflix, just for history. Lots of people going up there now. Use the code POD1, P-O-D-1, and you'll get a month for free, and then 1 month for just £1, euro, or dollar. In the meantime, everybody, enjoy Professor Mark Bailey. In this episode, I'm going to be focusing, perhaps appropriately, on the Black Death, a pandemic that swept across Eurasia in the 14th century and caused enormous casualties and saw huge change in its aftermath as well. I'm very, very lucky. I'm joined by Professor Mark Bailey. He's just delivered the very prestigious Ford Lectures at Oxford University. He's got a book out on this at the moment. He is exactly the right man to talk to. Mark, thank you very much for coming on this special experimental live podcast YouTube episode.
It's a pleasure, Dan.
People will have heard of the Black Death. Can you just give me the outlines? When and where did it emerge, and how fast did it spread?
The Black Death occurred in the middle of the 14th century, and we know from eyewitness reports who must have seen people dying in the late 1340s that the symptoms were buboes, pussy buboes, appearing in the lymph nodes, and blackness under the skin, which is effectively necrosis. Tissues are dying. And we also know from various sources about 30% of the European population, perhaps 50% of the English population, died. It spread very, very quickly and spread throughout the year as well. So it didn't seem to stop according to the seasons.
Did it emerge in the East and spread?
It did. We have a sense that it probably emerged from a reservoir of pathogens, which we think was Y. pestis, which is plague, somewhere around Mongolia, Tibet, Western China, and it spread in the 1330s and gradually came westwards throughout Europe.
I guess, unlike today when there's airplane travel, huge globalised communities, was it a little bit slower? What were their accounts of it as it was sort of progressing across the landmass?
Historians have been poring over documents from different parts of Eurasia for the last 10 or 20 years and have been able to reconstruct how it spread. It's probably reached the Middle East sometime in 1346. And then in 1347, it simply explodes across the Mediterranean littoral, which means that it's probably been carried in boats. Probably Italian, Venetian, Genoan galleys. It gets as far as the Balearic Islands by the end of 1347. So in that year, it is spreading hundreds of kilometres. And the interesting thing is that modern plague doesn't move very much during the winter, and it spreads much more slowly. So there's a significant difference between the speed, the seasonality, even the mortality of the medieval Black Death and modern plague. And that difference has caused historians a good degree of confusion in the recent past.
Yeah, worth remembering, of course, the plague still exists in certain places on the planet now. It hasn't entirely been stamped out like something like smallpox. Talk to me, I know this was a time also of climate change. Do you think that had any impact on the transmission of the plague?
One of the big questions for historians is why did the worst pandemic in recorded history suddenly explode across the known world? And in the past sort of 20 years, they've got a much better sense that there's a number of factors, chance events working in tandem to create this extraordinary catastrophe. One of the things is there's a high levels of population across Asia and Europe, high levels of malnutrition and poverty. Significant amount of trade is going on at this period between the Far East and Europe. So there is transmission through travellers and merchants moving across the continent. But most importantly, and perhaps intriguingly of all, something very, very strange is happening to the climate in the early 14th century. There's a sudden increase of storminess, significant variations from year to year in temperature, in precipitation, very rainy one year, very dry the next, very hot, very cold. And most remarkable of all, the Black Death moving across the known world between 1347 and about 1351 coincides with the coldest snap of the last millennium. It's extraordinarily cold, and scientists have even discovered that the Justinian plague of the 530s was also coincidental upon a serious reduction in the temperature of the world climate.
So as well as the plague, there would have been things like crop failure as well. I mean, this just sounds like a terrible time to be alive.
In 1349, plague hit England. The Black Death hit England, and the harvest failed. The harvest failed in 1350. It failed in 1351. Wait for it. It failed in 1352. It is the sole example in the second millennium of four back-to-back catastrophic crop failures. And at the same time, we know that, for instance, the price of fuel and the price of salt rockets. And what that is indicative of is extreme cold and a lack of solar radiance.
I understand the scholarship has kind of moved around on the importance of rats and whether or not they were to blame.
Yeah, yes. The high mortality rates in the middle of the 14th century, up to 50% of the population dying, the speed with which it travels and the time of the year throughout the year, means that the Black Death, which we traditionally assume is plague, but it's not behaving like modern plague. And so that created some confusion amongst historians and scientists who wondered whether, in fact, it was some other disease. And that debate was actually resolved about 10 years ago with advances in DNA technology, which was able to identify, would you believe, from the dental pulp of plague victims from seven plague pits throughout Europe, they were able to identify that the offending pathogen in the Black Death was indeed Yersinia pestis. It was plague, but it's plague behaving in a very different way to modern plague. So it's a different strain. And there's a sense, given the speed of the spread, that rather than being just a disease of rats, which it tends to be in the 20th century, it was more broadly a disease of rodents, of mammals. It transmits to humans, and it's perfectly possible that either human fleas, human lice, or even droplet infection between humans is the main mode of transmission of this particular disease. Because what we do know, and we have reconstructed, is that it's travelling down the main arterial routeways of medieval Europe. It's humans, not rats, it's humans that are transmitting this disease.
Was there anywhere in Europe that managed to avoid entirely the arrival of the plague?
In England, we've got some wonderful sources that show how this plague is spreading and deaths. And for 30 years, I've been trying to find a single place that was missed in 1348-49. And I found one single place. So in England, hardly anywhere missed. There is a sense that parts of Bohemia, bits of Germany and Poland might have missed in the main epidemic at the end of the 1340s, early 1350s. But the thing about this disease is that it kept coming back. It came back in 1361, 62. It came back at the end of the 1360s. And those places that missed it first time around certainly didn't miss second or third time around.
Did it affect all ages equally? And how about social classes? You know, did the rich suffer as much as the poor?
Well, we once thought that this killed indiscriminately, and certainly contemporaries felt that this was a very different disease that afflicted humanity equally. But from different sets of sources, we know that the death rates amongst the nobility were lower. Perhaps about a quarter of them died. And that's really because they must have known that it was coming, and they had multiple residences and were therefore much more able to be mobile during the passage of the epidemic locally, and able to move and to isolate themselves better. We also know from analysis of skeletons in plague pigs that it killed the elderly disproportionately, and younger people seem to have survived better. Whether they caught it and recovered or didn't catch it, we simply cannot know. But we know that the over 50s died disproportionately high. But here's the irony. 1361-62, the second great plague epidemic, which is probably the second worst health catastrophe of the last millennium, but pales into significance compared to the first outbreak, is often described by contemporaries as the plague of children, that it seems as though they then died disproportionately high during the second epidemic.
This idea that it keeps coming back, and it's not a single challenge that society has to face. I mean, how many waves of this were there?
This disease, and it is the same disease, of that we're certain, returns on another five occasions throughout Europe in the 14th century alone. In England in the 15th century, it recurs on another dozen occasions. And the final outbreak in England is, of course, the famous outbreak of 1665, but it's in France until the early 18th century. Of course, it becomes less virulent, it becomes less complete in its geographical spread. It kills fewer people on each of those subsequent visitations, but it's here. This is a golden age of pathogens that lasts for about three centuries. And one of the great unanswered questions is, why does it disappear? And we don't quite know why, because it's a complex interaction of both human response. Humans can take steps to reduce its spread, and they learn to do that. There's no doubt that some people must have caught it, built up immunity, and perhaps then were handing on a genetic immunity to subsequent generations. Plus, it's all to do also with the density of rodents, the density of the vectors, the fleas and so on. But also, epidemiologically, there is a tendency for pathogens to become avirulent over time. If they're too successful, they kill their hosts. and there's no host left for them to infect. So there's a tendency for mutation towards more avirulent strains of a given pathogen. So you put all those together and it disappears from England in the middle of the 17th century. But as you rightly said earlier, it's back. It is present currently on 5 of the 7 continents of the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I always associate with being a sort of disease of the 14th century. But I remember, you know, in 1600, when Queen Elizabeth was in her almost final year of her reign, there was an outbreak in England then. It's extraordinary. Did people's responses tend to change over those centuries?
The outbreak in London in 1665, so vividly described by Pepys, was serious and distressing, killed perhaps 5% of the population. But the great example that all British school children know of the village of Eyam in Derbyshire that effectively quarantined itself indicates that societies have learned that isolating people, isolating the sick, and stopping movement, stopping things like markets and trade, stopping people from moving around has a beneficial effect in restricting the spread of this terrible disease.
How did Hitler's sexuality shape his worldview? Why did the Black Death lead to the rise of the witch trials? And what are some of the sauciest scandals involving kings and queens at Hampton Court? I don't know about you, but this is the history I want to hear about. If you do too, then join me, Kate Lister, every Tuesday and Friday to find out the answers to all of these questions and more. Listen to Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex scandal in society, wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful. Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when you use messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage, add unlimited photos and videos, and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AURAframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
What about other responses in, say, the 14th century? What changes? You can't have 50% mortality in a society without sort of transforming it, presumably. What are the things that you historians have noticed happening in the 14th century?
I mean, one of the great challenges is actually burying people, and at a time when you don't have local authorities or substantial government, and at the same time trying to retrain priests, and much of that is done by private initiative and by charity. Perhaps the most interesting thing about the outbreak in the late 1340s in England is the involvement in the government in intervening and trying to provide some kind of coordinated response. It's important to remember that governments aren't large in the middle of the 14th century. They don't have a large bureaucracy. They're not particularly well funded. In fact, there's not really a sense of what the role of a government should be at a time of a national pandemic and crisis. But in England, the government intervenes in order to try and stabilise particularly prices, and also tries to secure the supply of labour. Because if half the population have died, there's a shortage of skilled and unskilled workers. So the government in England, on the 18th of June 1349, as the plague is developing throughout the country, pass something called the Ordinance of Labourers to try and fix prices, to stop them inflating, and to try and make labourers work, and to work for a maximum wage, not a minimum wage, a maximum wage for the common good.
We don't think of medieval governments being kind of interventionist on that scale, but they really were trying to grapple with this situation.
Yes, in some ways they were defining it as they were going along. There was no sense at this stage that central governments should be leading a quarantine response, for instance. In Italy, city-states and city governments started to introduce quarantine measures, and that's the first real example of that. The word quarantine comes from the Italian word quaranta, meaning 40 days. So the Italian city-states were the first to try and isolate the sick and to stop movement. In England, the intervention was much more about social policy and economic policy. And the government establishes the principle for the first time that governments have a role to intervene at time of crises to ensure social stability and to promote the common good of all people. They did so by trying to stop profiteering by making ordinary people work. So their sense of what the common good was is very different from today, but they were articulating that as they went along. And the big change in England is that thereafter, the government becomes a standing authority in social policy, and indeed sets the template for other governments around the world.
Should we dwell a little bit more on just what life must have been like during the peak of those outbreaks? I mean, it would have been something that would have brought everything grinding to a halt. You'd have seen it in every direction, I presume.
It's really difficult from the sources to get a handle on what it must have liked to have lived through it. They knew it was coming. And you can sense that in some communities, people are making dispositions in order to protect their wealth and so on and so forth and look after potential relatives. There's also some basic prophylactic, sweet smells, for instance, and attempts to make sure that burials would be looked after. But in particular, they wanted a proper religious ceremony for burials. And indeed, the experience of 1348, 49 meant that many people set up effectively communal self-help burial clubs called religious guilds in order to make sure there was somebody there to bury them during the course of a future epidemic. We know that 40% of all land in England changed hands in 1349. It is the greatest single transfer of wealth in one year because people are dying and heirs are then taking over the land. But throughout this, the most extraordinary thing is that local courts continued to be held, local religious services continued to be held. You'll get a sense that the markets are suspended, a lot of basic trading is suspended, and that people are relying on community self-help to get through this extraordinary year. But the administrative resilience and the way in which administrative structures cope is just remarkable. And a really good example of that is courts continue to be held. And the only thing that you notice that's different is the handwriting deteriorates. It's almost as if either scribes are rushing or there are less able scribes surviving and less literate scribes as a consequence. But the other thing that is remarkable is that when it comes back in 1361-62, it's serious. But thereafter, these local epidemics, you don't get a sense of any great disruption. You get a sense that communities have learned how to cope with this extraordinary recurrent catastrophe. There are clearly some outbreaks of local looting, and there are one or two local issues of law and order. But for the most part, law and order seems to have held in most places, and communities held. And I think, you know, what it shows is that within a crisis, there is also a sense of humanity which enables communities to come together and manage whatever is thrown at them. And they adapt. And I think that the message, particularly at the moment, is that communities have faced epidemics and pandemics many, many times before. And reactions are very different, but for the most part, they learn to cope and they emerge stronger at dealing with that aspect of their lives.
Well, Mark, I want to finish off by talking about why the plague was not just a catastrophic and tragic event for millions of families, but also how it really set history off on a different path, how it changed the course of history. What are some of the big changes that you have identified coming off the back of that first great bout of plague in the 14th century?
Among the main changes is that the way that people lived changed subtly but importantly. There was a sudden and major reduction in wealth inequality. Essentially, wealth went down the social scale because ordinary people could get land and their labour was suddenly in short supply. And some historians argue that the age of carnivorous Europe starts from the 1350s because the lower orders are now eating meat and dairy produce because they can afford it. There's also a huge jump in ale consumption after the Black Death, and we can document this. So pubs are probably, for the lower orders, are a consequence of the first great outbreak. And what that is people drinking ale as a source of carbohydrate and safe fluid as opposed to water. So it's improved living standards. So those are two fairly major changes. Labour shortages draw women into the workplace to a far greater degree. And in parts of Northwest Europe, that begins to create a change in family structures. So you get small nucleated families with women delaying the age of marriage or not marrying. It's called the North European marriage pattern. And the significance of that is that it increases the purchasing power of households over the course of the next two or three centuries. Why is that significant? Well, apart from the fact that it is, if you like, is the beginnings of girl power, of women in the workforce, but it also means that wealth per capita in Northwest Europe, and for another range of other reasons, is higher than other parts of the world. So what happens is that a particular institutional, economic, and social responses to the Black Death in the middle of the 14th century, then going on over the next two to three centuries, results in greater wealth in Northwest Europe. And as a consequence, it's taking the first tentative steps to modernity, to capitalism. It's called the rise of the West, the great divergence with the East and a little divergence within Europe, that the sort of economic powerhouses shift from Italy and Spain to Northwest Europe. And it is arguable that we simply would not have come to liberal modernity and current standards of living and technology had it not been for the Black Death.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us on this first live stream. I have learned a huge amount about that gigantic global pandemic. And in many ways, I think you've made me feel a little bit better about what we're going through at the moment for lots of reasons. Just let everyone know you've crushed all this expertise into a mighty book. Tell us what that's going to be called.
The book is called After the Black Death, and it will look at the responses in England in the later 14th century, and it'll be published by Oxford University Press by December.
Professor Mark Bailey, thank you very much, dude, for coming on.
I feel we have the history on our shoulders.
Hi everyone, it's me, Dan Snow. Just a quick request. It's so annoying and I hate it when other podcasts do this, but now I'm doing it and I hate myself. Please, please go onto iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, and give us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps, basically boosts up the chart, which is good. And then more people listen, which is nice. So if you could do that, I'd be very grateful. I understand if you don't want to subscribe to my TV channel. I understand if you don't buy my calendar, but this is free. Come on, do me a favor. Thanks.
Namaskaram, my name is Mayad. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come, follow me for a breakfast you will never forget. Namaste. Because you are going to make an incredible masala dosa under the watchful eye of my mom.
Kya baat hai, mom?
Each home adds their special touches. But not everyone gets to join in a traditional family meal. You will if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com. And don't just travel, explore.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.